Due to its length, this interview with Dr. Brian Krim will be presented in two parts. The first part is featured here, and the second part will follow at the end of this same broadcast week. I hope you enjoy our discussion.
The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Welcome to the program. Great way to start a week. We're all together. I think most of us are still sheltering in place. So we look forward to this time, Monday through Friday nights, where we get an opportunity to socialize a little bit through the chat room and actually hear some great conversation and very interesting discussion from some terrific guests. Slick Eddie does a really good job of bringing the guests in. Sometimes they're clustered around topics, and this happens to be one of those times, and it's just completely random based on book releases and stuff like that. We had a guest on last week, Dean Reuter. We talked about a book of his that discussed a Nazi war criminal, and I'm using that phrase, I'm not sure he did, although it's pretty clear he would have been considered a Nazi war criminal, who faked, according to his book, his own suicide, Hans Kammler. He was a general, an Obergruppenführer in the Third Reich, the Nazi army, in fact, in the SS. And we had this conversation about Nazi war crimes, the Holocaust, and things related to that. And tonight we actually have another discussion about a similar topic, Project Paperclip. Now, for those of you aren't aware what Project Paperclip is, it was an organized effort by the U.S. government and the U.S. military following World War II to gather and basically import into the United States a number of Nazi scientists, engineers. Some may consider them to have been war criminals themselves, but it was a secret project, and it was a real effort to keep those same scientists and engineers from falling into the hands of the Soviet Union. These are the people, these Nazi scientists and engineers, who developed technology that far exceeded anything that any other nation had, let alone the United States. Yes, we beat them to the nuclear bomb, to the atomic bomb, but they beat us to rocketry and many, many other things. So the U.S. military really wanted this information and this technology, of course, and we did not want the Soviets to have it. So there was a decision made along the way to maybe look the other way at some what we would call war crimes, certainly some heinous acts and some support of some heinous positions, and bring these scientists to the United States. Many of them became very, very successful. And we're going to talk about that tonight with Dr. Brian Krim. And he is a professor. He's also obviously an author and a researcher. He's written about this. And I'm anxious to have the conversation. It's going to be very interesting. Just looking ahead quickly, Memphis Ghost Investigations will be with us tomorrow night to talk about some of their ghost hunting experiences and efforts. We haven't heard from a group like this in a while, so I'm anxious to do that tomorrow night and looking forward to getting back into the ghost conversations. Always fun. Joe Gallenberger will be here Wednesday night to talk about telekinesis. And then Thursday night, we've got psychic medium Denise Marie joining us. That'll be another great conversation. So a week full of good stuff. Of course, Friday, if all goes well, booze, brews, and bros. We've been having some fun on Friday nights. If you haven't had an opportunity to join us for that, well, I won't call it a show because it's really not. It's more of a very casual get-together that we do through YouTube and Twitch and have an opportunity to unwind a little bit, talk about things that are just a little more humorous and a little more lighthearted. That's our Friday night program. So I hope everybody's doing well. Hope everybody had a great weekend, had an opportunity to relax. I mean, I don't know what you do. If you're not relaxing, what do you do in a time when you're not supposed to leave your home? I do think we're seeing a light at the end of that tunnel. I'm hoping we are. I'm excited that we very well may be because, you know, it's tough. It's tough to have nothing but four walls to look at for. What are we going on, a month? How long has this been? I remember that there was talk of this opening up around Easter time. That's when the original, wish date was set. And we've come and gone. We're a couple weeks past Easter, right? So we 5 weeks? Something like that. Anyway, I hope everybody's maybe making an opportunity to get reacquainted with your kids. Maybe do some projects around the house. Put up some shelves. I don't know. What projects do people do anymore? I don't do any of them. I built a deck once, And it actually came out really, really good. It was a very nice and well constructed deck, still on the house that I built it on. I don't own the house anymore. But after I did that, I said, you know what? I'm good with those kind of projects. Not really my cup of tea. I'd rather sit and write computer code. Although I don't do that much either anymore. So let's go to break. And when we come back, we'll bring in our guest again. Tonight, we'll be talking with Dr. Brian Krim. And we're talking about Operation Paperclip. By the way, he also has a book about another topic related to the Holocaust. It's called Planet Auschwitz, Holocaust Representation in Science Fiction and Horror. And I hope we have a little bit of time to touch on that one as well, because that's an interesting topic, particularly because I'm a horror film fan. I know of many of these movies that use Nazi representations, whether it's Nazi zombies or the undead, or there's a movie called Frankenstein's Army, where this German Nazi doctor creates part robot, part human creatures to fight. It's almost all tongue-in-cheek stuff, but it's entertaining nonetheless. Let's go to break. We'll be right back. It's Beyond Reality. Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/Johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W. Welcome back to the program. It's Beyond Reality. Thanks for being along with us. Just make sure you subscribe if you found the YouTube channel. And if you haven't found the YouTube channel, go to YouTube, search for JV Johnson. It's very easy to find. I looked today. There's like 850 videos there. Those are all back episodes of this program. They're all there for your enjoyment. There's no charge to subscribe or anything. We always appreciate support of the program, whether it's just in the form of a subscription or if you want to join our Patreon page, which, by the way, we have some new Patreon members that I will mention a little bit later in the show. Thank you to them. But either way, just being part of it is really important. And if you join the YouTube stream during the live show, you actually can participate in the chat room, which is a lot of fun. A lot of great people in that chat room. I say hello to all of you tonight, as I do every night, and appreciate you being there. Also, find us on Facebook, Beyond Reality Radio, and you can find my page. It's JV Johnson, or you can find it through JVJ Paranormal. Very easy to find. Tonight, we're going to be talking about something far more serious, however. Operation Paperclip, or some people know it as Project Paperclip, was and remains something very, very controversial, and I won't talk about it myself. I'll let our guest do that because he's far more eloquent with the topic. Brian Krim, Dr. Brian Krim, is a professor, an author, and a researcher, and we welcome him to the program. Brian, welcome to the show. Great to have you here.
Thank you, JV. Thanks for having me.
Let's find out a little bit about you first, because I happen to know that I've been a history buff since I can remember being interested in anything. And I was a real Civil War buff for a long time. Then I was a World War II buff for a long time. I still harbor those passions, but I don't get as much time to either read about it or explore those ideas. But you chose it as a bit of a career path. Tell us how that happened for you.
Yeah, you know, it's not an easy thing to be a historian these days. The humanities are not exactly really popular, and the job market is tough, but I hung in there. I started out as an intelligence analyst, so that's one of the reasons I was attracted to something like Paperclip. I kind of know how that world works. And I got my PhD really in modern European history, but it was a Holocaust specialty. And so when I started to really get into the topic of the Holocaust, obviously when you're really passionate about it, you want to teach the next generation, and that's what kind of motivated me. But also that little detour I had for about 5 years in the intelligence community helped me realize also that history is something that teaches you skills that matter very much in the real world, like intelligence analysis. You're piecing together a story from incomplete information, biased information. You have to boil it down for non-experts. And I found that to be just not only just a fascinating career and an important career, but it also mirrors kind of what I do in the classroom. And so with something like Paperclip, I wound up merging my interest of both Holocaust studies, modern German history, and intelligence history. And so the two of those things work really well together, and that is, the two of them are my passion.
I took a couple of college courses. Actually, I took a whole series of courses in college called the History of Western Civilization. And some people may think those courses are rather boring or mundane. I thought just the opposite. I found it explained so much about who I was and why we are as a nation and as a culture what we are, than anything I had ever heard. It struck me that much, and it created a love for me of Europe as well, and I've been many, many times, particularly in Germany. So I understand a bit of that that hook that grabbed you as well. But understanding these things not only helps us, as they say, not repeat mistakes of the past, which we see that happening all the time, but it also gives us an appreciation of who we are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that, you know, history, we tend to look at it as some sort of triumphalist narrative, like there's a mythology there. And once you get into, I think, higher education, that's peeled away for most students. They come in with high school textbook mentality, and a lot of it's really kind of garbage. And then when you get into a really upper-level class, you start to see, wow, what I was told is not exactly true. And that's when you really, like you said, kind of discover yourself. Like, and that we're all the things. We're the good thing. We are the Federalist Papers, but we're also genocide. We are, the glory of the Constitution and slavery. Yeah. And you have to tell it all. And I think that's really, how I approach teaching my students, too.
Yeah, you have to tell it all, and you also have to find ways to reconcile the two and not realize that they're mutually exclusive and that, as times change and attitudes change, people see things differently and start to recognize things that were customs or part of the culture as the mistakes they were, and that's part of maturing.
Yeah, and you can't be too judgmental, otherwise you lose sight of being a historian and you start to become a commentator, and that's a delicate balance, I understand.
I have to say, though, after saying that, I don't think I can apply that same standard to the Holocaust. The Holocaust is a big... right? That's not something we're going to look back at in a couple 100 years, 200 years, and say, oops, that was a mistake. We know better now, right? We knew that was wrong when it was happening.
Yeah, and when you talked about Western civilization, and I try to teach my students that, look, a lot of people look at the Holocaust as an aberration, that it's somehow a break from Western civilization, but you also have to realize that everything that made Western civilization is also in that horrific moment. Science, law, technology, bureaucracy, all those things that can make Western civilization efficient and wonderful can also become terrible in the wrong hands. And so it's part of a continuum. And it's also part of the story of Western civilization.
I have to ask you this because you not only study, write about, and research the Holocaust and some of these things we're going to be talking about tonight, but you also teach about them as well. What's happening in youth today? It seems as though there are many who don't even understand what had actually happened during those war years and what the Holocaust truly was and how horrific it was. And there are actually some that deny it happened. What are you seeing?
Right. I don't get so much denial as just complete and total ignorance, and that's on the spectrum of denial in a way. And I think so much of it is that, I don't know about your state, I live in Virginia, but I think most states have this SOL type of testing where it's all about you teach history to some test.
Yeah.
There's no critical thinking. There's not enough time to delve into topics very seriously unless you're, take an AP class or something like that. So they just aren't exposed to it. And it used to be that, every class got to listen to a survivor at some point. Well, now there's hardly any survivors left, so you're losing the actual living memory of the Holocaust. And I think it's just makes education so much more important that we're all that's left between losing that memory. And when you forget it, you don't, or it's just, in bad TV shows or bad movies as opposed to, quality work done, then of course they're going to forget it. They're not going to know anything. And that's what I deal with, and that's what I try to correct. But I see it getting worse every year, mostly because of that awful testing.
Yeah. What do you see in your students' reactions when you start to explain to them how horrific those actions were during the Holocaust? You must see their faces melt in some cases.
I most of the time I do, and some of them are so jaded, I think, because, look, this generation's already been through a lot. They're also exposed to so much graphic imagery every day that maybe when they see something that's on the historical record, it doesn't register. But I think really what you have to focus on are the personal stories. Sometimes it's not showing the awful videos. I don't like to show the bulldozers full of bodies and the things that I think maybe a lot of us grew up with. I like to just show them a YouTube clip of a survivor speaking in a room to another person, and that's it. And that's the sort of thing that breaks them, when they see just the pain on an old person's face recalling something, that to me is far more effective than try to bombard them with, you know, ugly imagery, because they get that already.
What do you find? I find it absolutely amazing, and I love watching, and I wish I'd had an opportunity to have some discussions myself with survivors, but I love watching these interviews. And so many of these people are so strong, and not only did they suffer the most horrific of circumstances and see so much death and torture, but they came out of it and they lived their lives. They just went on and lived. That's an amazing quality, and these people are some of the most amazing people that have ever walked the face of the earth.
You know, and one of the things that's common to their testimony is that even when they're going through it, they say, well, if I survive, I win. I beat them.
Yeah.
You know, that by having children, by getting married, you know, in the displaced persons camps that were erected, you know, just months after liberation, there was this wave of childbirths and marriages and, you know, just an just remarkable just will to live. And I think that's what carries on. You know, like, look, we win if we survive. We finally, even if we lost everybody in between, we've won by just producing another life or living life on our own terms. Not that you ever forget it.
And so many of them will ultimately say that they forgive the people that did these things to them. How is that? I mean, that's the highest of human qualities, I would say.
Yeah, and I've had a survivor come to our campus who did exactly that, and they were kind of gasped in the room. And she was one of Mengele's twins, if you can believe that.
Wow.
Not that she forgave him necessarily, but she forgave, you know, guards and things that she worked with.
Right.
But yeah, it either goes in one direction or the other. Just as many survivors, you become more religious or they deny God altogether, and you can understand both perspectives.
Sure.
And I think the ones that are coming out, you know, more in tune with their religion tend to be the more forgiving, but it's varied. But yeah, I've seen that happen in person, and it is jarring.
Let's talk about your book and the topic that it covers. We're talking about, of course, Our Germans, Project Paperclip and the National Security State. For those who might not know, and there are some that might not, what was Operation or Project Paperclip?
Now, simply put, the Operation Paperclip was the U.S. intelligence operation to find the best and the brightest German scientists working in a number of fields: rocketry, aeronautics, biological weapons, chemical weapons, and in some cases, just, you know, the hard sciences, before either other allies could take them, like the Soviet Union, but also France and Britain, and mine their minds for this knowledge and help contribute to the long-range defense planning of the United States. And it really began before the war was even over. You know, when they're planning D-Day, they know these scientists exist. They know there's important locations. It's all about finding them first, getting the material, the documents, and the machinery, and then eventually thinking it might be better to have the actual mines themselves. And Paperclip went beyond just trying to find them and detain them, but actually posited the notion that we should bring them to the United States for long-range exploitation. And that's what Paperclip officially was bringing these people, up to 1,500 of them eventually, to the United States for as long as necessary.
When these decisions were being made, first of all, maybe it's a good idea to set the stage. We know that, and most people know, that the Germans and the Nazis had functioning rockets. We did not. Many people probably know that the Nazis had jet aircraft that we did not.
Right.
So kind of set the stage as to how far ahead were they technologically at the end of the war?
Now, I think there's over the years, some mythology there that the Germans were so far advanced, and if they had, you know, they were so close to winning the war with some of these wonder weapons. They were very advanced in prototypes, except for the V-2 rocket, which was a working ICBM, essentially, but it contributed nothing to the military effort, and it killed a lot of civilians in England and the Netherlands, and it was a breakthrough in military technology, but it also was a lot of effort and misdirected. So while the United States is building the atomic bomb, the Germans are building these boutique weapons that had contributed nothing to their to victory, obviously, and took a lot of energy away from more useful matters they could have dealt with. But things like the jet aircraft, for example, were brilliant, except they came way too late and they could never mass produce them. They had electric submarines that could, you know, go underwater for, you know, far longer than any other battery could and travel great distances. But again, they had a handful of them. This is the German problem all along. They had brilliant minds, but were never able to mass produce these that have an effect during the war. What the United States wanted to do is take those brilliant minds and harness it to our own enormous industrial capacity that we had proven to be very effective, and see if we could ultimately take the best from both worlds and unite them in a, you know, concerted effort to build a modern national security state.
Was the reason they couldn't mass produce them because at the time that the technology had become available to them, as they've developed it, that their infrastructure had already been so crippled by the war effort and their resources had been dwindled?
That's a big part of it. They had to move underground, which is where the V-2 is built. And you know, that automatically limits what you can do. And also their fuel supplies were completely shut off. And one of the reasons where they were in North Africa with Rommel and that effort was to get closer to the oil field. Well, they could not, they had ordered the Caucasus in Russia. That was taken away from them.
Yeah.
But what they did is they created synthetic fuel, which was pretty amazing. So they always had a solution, but it could never be mass produced. And by the time you get to 1944, when most of these things are coming online, well, they're already basically in a defensive posture and it's a waiting game till their eventual defeat.
So at what point was Operation Paperclip organized and actually officially sanctioned? And I have to assume that the President of the United States sanctioned it. And what department did it come from? State Department? Defense Department? Give us the origins.
Yeah. So every military service, which is one of the problems the United States always has, that there's so much competition between every so many bureaucracies and the military services especially. But it was really the Navy were the first ones that came up with the idea, well, can we bring some of these people over to the United States? And that was, you know, April, May of 1945. Remember, the war ends in May of 1945. So it was a War Department effort to find, first and foremost, the rocket team. So about the 120 scientists that did build these V-2s, these terror weapons, they were the primary target. And so what was called at the time Operation Overcast was sanctioned by President Truman in July of 1945 to just bring over 350 scientists and personnel to work just on the V-2. And so that's what he wanted to limit to this special group of people. And then Paperclip was an expanded program that allowed up to 1,000 scientists. And again, Truman agreed to this, but he also said only if they're vetted properly. There could be no, as he put it, hardcore Nazis in this group. Well, the military didn't, I think they lived by the letter of that law, but not the spirit, because they basically just didn't check to see if they were vetted or not. They just took who they wanted and didn't bother to look into their past. That's where the name Paperclip comes from. In fact, Paperclip meant that if you had a dossier of a scientist you knew was a war criminal or had a very, very sketchy past that could never pass muster under this executive order, you put a paperclip on that dossier, and that communicated to everyone down the line, do not look at this very carefully because otherwise we'll get in trouble. So it's one of the few times that a code name like actually told you what the operation was. Paperclip was you put a paperclip on the people you want to bring over, and that way no one's going to look too closely to their background.
Well, that was going to be my next question. So in the discussions as this operation was being planned and structured, do we have any of the records? I imagine they, at the time they would have been classified, maybe still are, I don't know, where we had this conversation about what to do if we had a brilliant mind who was a hardened Nazi and maybe even a war criminal.
We do have that now. Thanks to around 1999, this is an effort that started with the Clinton and through the Bush administration. There was a lot of pressure from Congress to open up the files on issues just like this, like how much cooperation did the United States enter into with former Nazis and Imperial Japanese personnel as well, but mostly Nazis. And so around 2010, there was 12 million files declassified, and that's what I used, not all 12 million, but I used that record group to write this book. And it's all there. It's what's shocking is that it says in black and white, you cannot have members of the SS. You cannot have someone who is listed as Category 1 Nazi, all very detailed. And so the people in charge of the investigation was the military government and the Army Counterintelligence Corps. They would do legitimate investigations on the people on the list that were supposed to come over. And whenever they found, someone who did horrible things, they would put it in their file. Then another part of the government, it was called the Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency, they would take those files and literally just change the wording in them or erase some of the words, such as so-and-so is an ardent Nazi. They would change it to so-and-so is not an ardent Nazi. Mm. It was literally that obvious and blatant what they did. And you can compare the records one by one, and that's what I did.
I don't want to get too far ahead of myself in the conversation, yeah. But if things were being changed and documents were being altered, and these folks may have had a justification for doing so at the time. I mean, there was a different world. We had a Soviet Union that was becoming quickly our adversary, not our ally. But did anybody get in trouble for doing that?
No, absolutely not. No one was watching, and no one wanted to ask those questions. In fact, the only people who got in trouble were the ones who stood in opposition to Project Paperclip for exactly standing up to this wrongdoing. And the State Department in particular were the ones who had a problem with immigration of these people, and they were the ones who got in trouble for daring to stand up to it.
How many German scientists did it ultimately include? You said the original batch was 350 or so, but how many did it ultimately encompass?
Well, it's 1,500 to 1,600 scientists, technicians, and personnel, and that does not include family members, because once they sign these contracts, they can not only bring their immediate family, but also even their extended family. So you're bringing over thousands of more that way. But a total of 1,500 to 1,600 over the course of say 1945 to 1955, but a version of this really went into the 1960s as well, when there was an independent Germany. So they're actually taking Germans from a sovereign country of West Germany.
So, and it wasn't just the United States and its allies that were doing this, or maybe even just, I don't know if we were doing this in coordination with our allies or not, but the Soviet Union was trying to do the same thing, weren't they?
They were, and that's one of the reasons that we escalated our own exploitation program, it was called, is that we knew that the Soviets were equally interested, and they cared even less about the backgrounds of the scientists. They assumed that every German walking was a hardcore Nazi. They didn't play these games about did they do this or did they do that. They just took who they wanted. The problem was that most Germans, if given a choice, wanted to go to the Western zones or the United States to work and not the Soviet Union. But the Soviets had a very compelling offer themselves. They used every trick in the book. They would either use intimidation, show up to your house with a gun, or they would bribe you and pay you far higher than even the Americans did. It was a scattershot approach. It wasn't very well done, but they certainly did not waste time investigating the backgrounds of the scientists. They just took them, or they bribed them. And once we heard about that, the U.S. intelligence community said, well, we better be on our toes here and just expedite any investigation we have, and if they look bad, then we just change the record.
Two questions. Who got the better end of the, well, that's not a good way to ask it. Who got the better scientists? And secondly, was anyone captured, I'll say, by the Soviet Union that we really, really wanted?
Yeah, you could say overall the United States got the better scientists and the Soviets got more of them. They probably by 10 to 1, the Soviets had more.
Oh, wow.
But the cream of the crop was Wernher von Braun and the rocket team. But members of that team also made it to the Soviet Union. In particular, the head of the Germans in the Soviet Union was the number three under Wernher von Braun. His name was Helmut Gutrup, and he's responsible for building their long-range rockets, and he had a major role in what would become Sputnik. So we desperately wanted him, but the Soviets got him first. They took his family. They bribed him. They made life as comfortable as they could for him. But overall, I think the Soviets were envious of who the United States was able to get. Yet, I think it's a wash as a terms of the long-term influence, however.
Was it just scientists and engineers and their families, or were there also like industrialists or some type of, you know, more corporate type researchers?
Yeah, that's a funny thing I found, because Wernher von Braun was able to bring whoever he wanted. He could simply tell his army captors and then later his patrons, look, I want this group of people. And he wound up getting a bunch of patent lawyers and people he worked with over the years that had no scientific ability. And some of them were just really sketchy people that had horrible backgrounds and didn't even have anything to offer. So, yeah, we got a lot of exactly corporate types, people who did were management in some of these German companies that built some of these prototypes. They had some value, I suppose, but it was strange to see people who are basically corporate lawyers being mentioned in the same breath as, you know, physicists and aeronautical specialists.
We recognized that this was important, or some people did, right near the ending of the war, so in spring of 1945. And as you mentioned, this program extended into the 50s and actually into the 60s in some fashion. So what were these people doing for those years following the war, but before they became part of this and brought to the United States?
Well, there wasn't much time between that, but what the United States did is first try to exploit them in country, in Germany. So they built these special camps just for people of interest. They had one for former German military officers that they wanted. They had one for intelligence people, and they had several for scientists. And the deal was, you know, if you can live on these essentially glorified prison camps, your family will get more food and shelter than they would in bombed out Germany. But over time, there's so many security risks here, because the Soviets and, believe it or not, the French were far more good at, you know, kidnapping scientists out of these places and hiring them than even the Russians were. It became this real fear that if we keep them in, you know, occupied western part of Germany, they're going to be either taken over by the Soviets or they're going to slip through the barbed wire here, and we're never going to find them again. So that was part of the reason for Paperclip, is, well, let's bring him to the United States, where at the very least they are not going to fall into enemy hands or friendly competition hands like Britain or France.
Yeah.
So it was really a short term period before they came in that end of the war and before they came here.
So let's talk about that a bit. What was the position of our allies, France and England? As this was happening, were they trying to get the same people for themselves? And obviously, you said the French were better at, you said, I think you used the word kidnapping. Was there really some of that going on?
Yeah, it was. It was like a Wild West atmosphere. I try to describe that world in my book, is that this was, you know, open border. We think about these zones of occupation. We have this image of the Cold War where everything is tightly controlled. It was a free for all in the early days of the occupation. I mean, zones could easily just be, you know, traversed, and in any way, and we tend to think of, especially even the British, as our closest friends. But they wanted the same people too. They wanted Wernher von Braun. But we had, you know, we stole them right from underneath them and just paid them more. And the French didn't care about any previous agreement. They literally did send agents into the American zone. They pushed scientists into moving cars, drove them over the French border, and suddenly they're now working at a French company. And the Russians had the classic honeypot trick, where they would have a beautiful woman lure a scientist into a hotel room, and waiting for him was a NKVD officer with a passport and a paybook, and say, you're now coming with us. The files are filled with these stories. I just tried to even give a taste of them because there's so many.
I know you've written about some pop culture stuff too, and I hope we get a chance to talk about that book at the end of our discussion. But it sounds to me like these little outlines that you've given us in describing what the competition was between nations, it sounds like some great fodder for some spy movies.
And I used to love all these movies before I got into Paperclip. I realized that this is just reporting the facts. I mean, they don't even have to make anything up here. It's some of it is truly bizarre, and you would expect it always from the Russians because that's how we tend to, you know, think of them, and our movies show us that. But the French were even, and the diplomatic traffic shows you this. We're far angrier at France than we are at the Soviet Union, for example, and say, you know, 45 and 46. We're not yet looking at the Soviet Union as a problem. It's really all of them are a problem.
Yeah, I would imagine the attitude there was, we know the Soviet Union is an adversary, but we just helped the French get their nation back. We saved England from losing theirs. You'd think we wouldn't be in competition with them. You'd think we'd have some gratitude.
Yeah, everyone was looking for reparations, and that's even the word we used for Paperclip, is we get intellectual reparations by taking these people. And the French are like, look, they occupied us for, you know, 4 years here. We're more than that. We're taking them all, and we're going to pay them. And if they were, we'll threaten them either way. So it was everyone was used the carrot and the stick, and the French were pretty good at both.
All right, let's go to break here. Again, we're talking tonight with Dr. Brian Krim, and we're talking about his book. It's called Our Germans, Project Paperclip and the National Security State. Let's talk about how the selection process happened for these, in many cases, Nazis, German scientists. Who was in the room? Who was making the decisions? And was it a case of like almost like a baseball draft in the sense that you had maybe the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, some commercial corporate interests? What was happening in that room?
You know, it's all the above. When you mentioned, I mean, there was the Department of Commerce. You had Bulova Watch Company. You had GE. You had IBM. What would become the major aeronautic corporations, Douglas Aircraft and all, they were all in the room. But what really was it was a small group called the Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency, which was primarily military. And it was led by an O6, you know, either a Navy captain or a Army colonel. And that's a relatively low rank of power these people had. And they were the ones that worked off of this list called the Ozenberg list. The story of how they got the list is pretty amazing. Right around the 1942, end of 42, the SS compiled their own list of 15,000 German scientists that they thought would be useful for the war effort, and they wanted to put them on the list so they wouldn't be drafted accidentally and could be put to work. And someone in Polish intelligence got a hold of that list and was able to get a copy to the Allies, and particularly to the Americans. And so we worked off of this list of 15,000 names to develop the kind of, you know, the dream team for Paperclip. And that's what the JIOA used to track down who they wanted. And in some cases, they fell into their hands. Like, you know, Wernher von Braun drove across Germany to get to the Americans before the Soviets got to him. So you're lucky there. But in other cases, everyone was working off the same list, and it was this small group of people who were really answerable to nobody. They have this thin veil of an executive order that basically let them do anything. That probably sounds familiar these days, but it was kind of shocking then.
Was there any effort by maybe loyal Nazis to thwart or maybe even assassinate some of these people?
Yeah, there was. In fact, that's one of the reasons why the rocket team led by von Braun fled where they were, which was kind of on the Baltic coast near the Soviet zone. It wasn't that they were afraid the Soviets would overrun them right away. They were fearful that the SS, which was in charge of the rocket program by the end of the war, were going to kill them all before they fell into enemy hands. And there was a reasonable suspicion that was going to happen. So it wasn't out of the question. So ran off and got a bunch of jeeps and started driving toward Bavaria. And that's a very real threat.
What about, did any escape Germany? We know that a lot of Nazis went to South America. Did any escape Germany proper and we had to go find them?
Well, many times they did wind up in places like, obviously, South America, Egypt, Turkey was a real haven for some really bad characters, not just scientists. But they really had no problem finding a safe place in any of the Allied countries. And when we did find a scientist that we knew was too controversial, whether you could even hide their record because they were so bad, the United States actually helped them get to Argentina and would use their knowledge there with an agreement with the Argentine government, you know, Perón government. And Alan Dulles himself, you know, the first head of the CIA, was, well, second, if you want to, when it was the CIA, but he actually helped get some really notable scientists to Argentina under this agreement that, look, we can't keep them here, but can we use what they're producing on like a, you know, just cooperate by giving us the results of their research. So we were the ones helping them escape in some time.
Tell me how bad the bad ones were. If there are a couple that stand out to you that really should have been in Nuremberg at the trials for the crimes they committed, any make that list?
They do. I mean, I think for the most part, the really awful ones don't make it to the United States, or if they do, they don't last long. But there are a few. For example, the one we did send to Argentina was in the United States for a while. His name was Walter Schreiber, and he was an epidemiologist. And so he would test bioweapons on concentration camp victims. And that was just how he did his business, and that's how German science operated. He was in the United States for a while until the Air Force found out, well, the press actually got a hold of this information, and all of a sudden he had to be dispatched to Argentina where no one could touch him. That was one. And most of our Air Force medicine comes from awful research conducted in concentration camp.
Wow.
Places like Dachau and Bergen-Belsen. You've probably heard of the so-called cold experiments where you dump inmates into frozen water to see how long it takes for them to die, or the pressure experiments where you subject inmates to horrific low pressure and high pressure to determine how well, what point do they die. That data is used and was used by U.S. Air Force medicine, and some of the doctors who conducted those experiments wound up in San Antonio building our own aerospace medicine program, and some of them stayed for decades. Now, they weren't probably the ones that actually conducted the experiment, but they ordered it. They oversaw it. They used the data. Being that one step removed from something like that is pretty common. And I think that's the most egregious case, is especially the aerospace medicine people.
You know, obviously the United States government and the military particularly had a real interest in this technology and these ideas and being ahead of the Soviet Union on all of it. But there was also a scientific community here that was doing a lot of this work itself already. What was their attitude on these Nazis coming here and becoming involved in their work?
You know, that's one of the things that struck me, is that, you know, the Army, the military, was really believed in this myth of the great German mind, that somehow just by being a German scientist, they're better than our own scientists. And they said that all the time. And I'm thinking to myself, who built the atomic bomb? Yeah. We did these things, but there was this disconnect between the military and the civilian scientific community, which is almost universally opposed to paperclip, not just for moral reasons, but because it actually did threaten their jobs. You had some of these German scientists are taking very high-paid civil service jobs, and then later corporate jobs that could easily have gone to American scientists. And so most were opposed. You also had a fair number of German Jewish refugees who had been in the United States since the 30s working in the scientific community that literally had to work side by side by Nazi scientists.
Oh, yeah.
That was a common story. People like Einstein were writing New York Times editorials condemning paperclip once it became public. And so, yeah, most American scientists saw it as a double threat. One, to the kind of morality and pristine nature of what they saw as research science, and then also job security.
This is a hypothetical, so I'm not sure if we can get a real answer to this question, but I'm curious as to your thoughts on it. How high up the hierarchy was the U.S. government and the people making these decisions willing to go for technology? And for example, a hypothetical, let's say Hermann Göring was a mastermind of aerospace technology, and he was responsible for jet fighters and rocketry and those things. Yeah. Would we have accepted someone of his level and his culpability as a member of this effort?
No, I think I can answer that question by comparing a case study that actually happened, which is in Japan. The equivalent of a lieutenant general was in charge of their bioweapons program. And we brought that person we were talking one of the worst of the worst. And we brought him to the United States and picked his brain, prevented him from getting being wrapped up in the equivalent of the Nuremberg trials in Japan because he provided such valuable information. Now, was he as high as someone like Göring? No, but that proved to me that we clearly had no compunction about taking any steps necessary if the research is deemed that valuable. It's more difficult when the person is public, and that wasn't the case. Wernher von Braun was sort of a well-known commodity, but he also didn't have his hands dirty in the way that someone like Göring did. But if there's a way around it, they would have done anything possible to avoid humiliation by having it eventually discovered. Well, that's something that they could cover up more easily in the late 40s than they could now. So I don't think it would have been too much of a stretch at all.
You mentioned that in one particular case, the press got a hold of some information which forced, I don't remember the name of the gentleman that you had mentioned, but he was sent to Argentina to make him untouchable. Mm-hmm. How common was the knowledge of this, and how closely was the press watching it?
That was Walter Schreiber, and he was a particular case just because everyone knew he was in the country, but the background came out later. So the fact that he was a German scientist who did awful things wasn't a surprise, but that he did that level of awful things surprised people. But the army knew this was going to come out because you can't have hundreds of Germans living in Ohio and Texas and New right. Mexico and Virginia and Boston and not have people wonder what's going on. So as early as October 1946, they put out press releases, and they invited local press into Wright Field in Ohio and whatever and said, look at these Germans. They work for us now. And sure, it was sanitized, but they basically laid out really everything paperclip was and expected it to be unpopular but also quickly forgotten. And that turned out to be true. So I quote a Gallup poll where basically it said that 75% of Americans disapproved of paperclip when they heard about it. But how much they did or how much it stayed with them was another question. And once the Cold War starts to become a reality, then people aren't thinking about it at all. And the people who are opposing it are people you might expect, an Einstein, the NAACP, the American Jewish Congress. Sure, they're going to be upset, but most Americans just go about their business. So I was amazed by just how public it was.
How was it handled when they got here? Most of us who have any familiarity with this project, this process, know the ultimate fate of Wernher von Braun and how successful he was here. But what was done? Were these people kept in camps when they got here? And did they just go to work in an office like everyone else did? How did this happen?
Right. Yeah, they started out in really kind of glorified military custody. So they at Wright Field, they had the same kind of housing as officers. And what's really interesting is that there are still German POWs at Wright Field. And so they basically were assigned to be the kind of servants to these German scientists. They would do their laundry. They would, clean their rooms. It was kind of a strange scenario. But then when they realized that, because initially paperclip was a 6-month contract, so they didn't feel like they had to do much to keep them happy. But then when they realized that the morale was really low, the scientists were complaining and they missed their families, then by mid-1946, the idea is, well, we better bring their families here and even offer immigration status. And that's what changed the game. That's what made paperclip a temporary, let's take these POWs and get what we can out of them into something that I think most Americans find horribly distasteful, which is let's celebrate them, give them citizenship while there's tens of thousands of displaced persons who can't come to America on quotas that the Nazis are using. And let's not only do that, but let's make them civil servants as well. So there, the switch happened really over the course of mid-1946 to spring of 1947.
A lot of people credit Wernher von Braun with America's ultimate success in getting to the moon. My question to you is, do you credit him with that? And secondly, can you point to, are there any other obvious or, lesser known success stories like that of any of these scientists that we should be talking about?
Yeah, I'll preface it by saying I am not a historian of science and technology, but I consulted all those who I knew were and their books about the American space program and the German contribution. And they all agree that what Paperclip does and Wernher von Braun did specifically was help the United States catch up to where the Germans were in 1945. We were about 5 years behind, and he got us to the level of the B-2 almost immediately with in his early months in the United States, and that was truly important. And the Soviets had their Germans do the same thing for them. What Wernher von Braun was a genius at was as a project manager. He could take something on a blueprint and turn it into a workable product quickly and efficiently and figure out how to mass produce it as well. And so that's not to say he wasn't a great physicist. He got a PhD when he was 20. I mean, he's all those things. But really what he was a very skilled project manager. And most of the historians of science I talked to say, look, what he did, any American scientist coming out of Georgia Tech or the Jet Propulsion Lab, which also probably had more to do with the space program than anything else, he was in a position to do things that any American could, but because it was him, we remember him and lionize him when it could have been any number of people with a similar background and training. So it's not so much was it he's so special, is it just he's just so unique for being there at the right time with the right group around him, which was by the time he gets to the late space program is a mixed group of Germans, Americans, and other refugees, in fact.
So are there any other examples of that kind of success that maybe we wouldn't be household names, but maybe their achievements would be?
There are the number of scientists who were great in the private sector. So I mentioned the Bulova Watch Company. You have people working for Kodak that benefited greatly from specific German scientists. Arthur Rudolph is a very controversial person because he was the only German to actually have to leave the country because he had the threat of prosecution. But he was really the father of the Saturn V and was also one of Wernher von Braun's close associates. But Arthur Rudolph did have, he's exactly the type of moral dilemma we have here because he do have this genius, but he was directly responsible for war crimes, including ordering the mass hanging of workers in an underground factory in Germany. He directly was responsible for a war crime. Yet without him, the Saturn V was, defunct. That's an uncomfortable thing to kind of contend with.
We talked about what our allies were thinking and doing, and we talked about what the Soviets were thinking and doing, but was there any other protesting or concern coming from the international community?
From the international community, not really, which is interesting. There was also, I think it was more about envy, why do they have them and we don't, and what are we doing to keep up? The British, what they did is they would also had similar problems. They couldn't have some of these high-profile Nazis wandering around England, especially when some of them especially are responsible for, killing thousands of civilians with the V-2.
That's right.
So what they did is they would send them places like Canada and New Zealand and Australia. They'd use the Commonwealth to hide them. So there's not much protest from the rest of the world, except maybe the Federal Republic of Germany, when they are a sovereign country in 1949. They're protesting the fact that their best minds are being stolen from them, and that they did protest openly, and that did force the United States to actually have to change tactics and cover it up a little better and and make some kind of compensation to now a sovereign government.
We have seen some high-profile war crimes. I'm trying to remember when the last one was, and I think I just watched a documentary about the butcher of, I'm blanking now.
Klaus Barbie.
That's right. Anyway, you know, we've seen some of these, and we know that there were groups dedicated to going out and finding Nazi war criminals. What were they saying about some of this?
You know, it was funny. A lot of people probably watched the Amazon show Hunters, which is, you know, a fictional take on Nazi hunters. And Project Paperclip was the jumping off point for that story. And I actually did a documentary for them for Amazon to coincide with the show, to kind of do the real Paperclip. And they asked the same thing, like, where was the truth behind it? Well, obviously nothing in the show is true, but Simon Wiesenthal, who was a real Nazi hunter, did have a number of paperclip scientists on his list of people who had to face justice, and the government did hide them sufficiently enough that he never got a hold of them. But the group that did go after Paperclip was within the Justice Department, and that didn't happen though until much later in the 1970s, the creation of the Office of Special Investigation. Was dedicated to hunting war criminals, not just Nazis, but that's really who they're after at first. And they found themselves in the position of investigating the military. This is how the truth of Paperclip, I think the sketchy parts of it came out, was that you had one part of the government investigating the other. That's something we're kind of used to now, but it was a shocking thing for the Justice Department and the FBI to suddenly go find the secrets out of the military and see that they were complicit in hiding these people, breaking our own immigration laws and our own denazification policy, and that. But yet, that doesn't come out until the 1970s.
Times of war and times of even the Cold War, which is exactly what it sounds like. It was a Cold War, but it was still a war of sorts. Sometimes call for strange measures and strange policies. On balance, as you look back and with all the research you've done on this, all the commentary you've seen on it, and the information you've compiled in your book, do you think this was a justified trade-off of looking the other way, of some people that may have done some terrible things in exchange for the capabilities, the technology, and the information they brought to us? Was it worth it?
Yeah, when I wrote the book, what I wanted to do is get beyond what I think were two competing schools of history. One was the celebrating of the paperclip and the rocket team in particular, seeing them as like heroes and basically the Wernher von Braun image of this American hero, the Disney icon. I mean, getting beyond that, and the other side, which sees paperclip as this horrific evil conspiracy that betrayed American values. What I wanted to show was that there was this balance here, that it wasn't an either-or situation. Now, my whole approach here is that Paperclip was rather ordinary when you look at how national security policy was created after World War II, that within the context of building this national security state that we take for granted, it wasn't that amazing. What's amazing about it is that it was so open and obvious, and they didn't try to hide the certain aspects of it, and that it just became business as usual. What I wanted to expose is that this is something we take for granted. Now, the moral lesson is, should we take this for granted? Do we make these moral calculations on a daily basis? I think we do, but we have to be honest with ourselves and can't. And whenever we issue phrases like American exceptionalism and our foreign policy is grounded in human rights and morality, well, we can't say that when we look at an operation like Paperclip and see that we are making these horrific choices about whether to sacrifice our values for what at the time was relatively short-term technological gain. And just writing a complete history of the project to me is a way for Americans to come to grips with it and decide for ourselves if this is who we are. This is what we want to be, because we make these types of choices on a daily basis now. Telling the truth about what we've done in the past can really provide, you know, some insight and allow us to decide for ourselves what can be done in our name, because Paperclip is done in our name collectively. And I think the choices are not always easy, and I try to show that it was some cases lawful, but in other cases it was highly irregular and immoral. It was all of those things. You can't condemn it totally, and nor should you ever be celebrated.
We're going to go to break here in just a moment, and when we come back from the break, I want to talk about your new book, Planet Auschwitz, for just a moment. But before we do that, the Project Paperclip, Operation Paperclip book is called Our Germans, Project Paperclip and the National Security State. Where can people find it?
You can buy it pretty much anywhere. On Amazon, I see it's, you know, it's under $20 now. The paperclip just, the paperback just came out a couple of months ago, and that's easily under $20 on Amazon. So yeah, go there. Go to Johns Hopkins University Press. You name it, you can find it.
That concludes the first part of my discussion with Dr. Brian Krim. Tune in later in the week for the second half of this discussion from Beyond Reality.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by J.V. Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Joha Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal, or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y, at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.